This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with singer and songwriter Mark Mulcahy. If you're not familiar with Mulcahy's music, this might get your attention. The novelist Rick Moody called Mulcahy's latest album among the very best records of 2013. In an article in Salon, Moody wrote, quote, "The recording bristles with wordplay, with remarkably inventive lyrical turns, contains some of the best singing by a musician known as a singer's singer, is full of despair and provocation, and rocks harder than almost anything that has come out this year. Considering the context, the result is explicably full of loss from the first song to the last." Unquote. The context to which Moody is referring is the unexpected death of Mulcahy's wife in 2008. The couple's twin daughters were almost three at the time. To meet the demands of single parenthood, Mulcahy stopped recording and touring. A tribute album featuring Michael Stipe, Tom York, and other singers performing Mulcahy's songs was released in 2009. Mulcahy was in the band Miracle Legion in the 80s. And for the Nickelodeon TV series The Adventures of Pete and Pete, he formed a house band called Polaris, which performed the show's theme song. Terry asked Mark Mulcahy to bring his guitar to the studio, and he did even more than she requested. He brought his guitar, as well as a great guitarist with whom he'd worked for many years, Ken Murie. Let's start with a track from Mulcahy's 2013 album. This song is called She Makes the World Turn Backwards.
Impolite and insecure, and in spite of it all, he thinks you're perfect. You're fully focused, honey, on the prize. His hand, dear, until he cries, Uncle, where does it hurt?
Everywhere.
Can you stand up?
I don't care.
Are you worried?
Yes.
There's no explaining her behavior.
We know, we know.
Like a liar loves.
That She Makes the World Turn Backwards from Mark Mulcahy's new album. Mark Mulcahy, Ken Murie, welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you so much for being here. I really love that song, Mark. And I think, in terms of the writing, I really especially love the line, "Where does it hurt? Everywhere." Can you talk a little bit about what inspired the song or your approach to writing it, especially with the Q&A part there?
I think what happened when I started writing that song was just after I had a conversation with a friend of mine who was getting divorced and was surprised by the divorce. And so he was talking in that sort of desperate way, and I imagined his circumstance maybe. And it's not necessarily completely about him, but that was the idea of the song.
The title of your latest album is Dear Mark J. Mulcahy, I Love You. Where does that come from?
It's a note I got from somebody, and at the time when I got it, I just had it. I didn't think of anything about to use it, and I hung it on the wall. And when I was trying to think of a title for my record, I walked past it, and I thought, you know, that's sort of because of the way I made the record I have, and because of my life at that moment, I felt very lucky to have a lot of people, you know, that I know cared about me, and so I thought it summed up something about not only just the record, but just everything. And I tried it out on people. And, you know, I have some friends are like, "Dude, please don't call your record that. It's the worst title I've ever heard." And then one day I realized, I was driving, and I realized that it was kind of like a movie title, and that the whole of the information of what the album was in one sentence. And I didn't have to be, you know, Bazooka Man by Mark Mulcahy. It was all just one sentence. And I really just loved that. And that's when I made the decision that, you know, it's like sort of like a movie name.
Who wrote the note? Was it a fan?
Who wrote the note? It was actually my daughter.
Oh.
So I don't know why she called me Mark J. Mulcahy. That's just a little joke they have to call me by my name. They think it's hilarious. So it's, you know, it had a lot of things. There's so much going for it that I can't.
Oh, I can see why that would really mean a lot to
you. It was just an undeniable thing for me to call it that.
Well, I know your wife died 5 years ago, and since then you've been raising your children alone, two twin girls who were three.
Three, yes. Almost three.
Yeah. So, and this is your first album since then.
Yes.
Why was the time right now to do an album?
Oh, well, I felt like I could probably do more than I was doing, because when I started taking care of my children by myself, you know, it's really, you know, I was so unqualified in the beginning, and it just took me so long. It's such a steep curve to figure out how to do it, that it took me, you know, a few years. I mean, it's still, obviously, it's still something I'm still learning how to do, but it took me so long just to be able to make it all work, you know, to get all the meals and, you know, everything, you know. So I felt like, you know, they're at an age where they can, they're very, you know, functioning people now in a lot of ways. So I just kind of thought I could probably get away with it. And it's been a struggle in some ways, because children take up a lot of your time and there's only them X hours in the day. So it's been a struggle, but I've had some great help to get away with it. I feel like I'm getting away with something on some level to be able to go play shows and to, you know, do this and do interviews and things. But I've always thought that, you know, you have to do your own thing. If you're going to have children, you can't just be the parent all the time. You have to be something else. Otherwise, you're not bringing anything to it. You're just this, you know, monolith of orders and rules and things. And so I'm a happier person, to be doing what I'm doing.
How did you make a living if you couldn't perform?
Well, there were three concerts people put on to raise money for me, which, you know, that is a very kind of humbling thing, you know, to have. I've never had anyone raise money for me. And it's very strange and humbling. And I wasn't sure. I didn't say anything. I didn't say a word because everyone, it was all done. I didn't have anything to do with it. So, and, you know, they give you the money at the end. And I thought, God, I didn't know how to react in any way. But that money was very important. It was very helpful to keep things going. And, you know, there was a record they made
a
tribute record to my wife's name and to people covering my songs. So there was some amount of fundraising going on. And, you know, somehow we made it.
Mark, I'd like you to do an original song. And this is a song you haven't recorded yet. And it's called Don't Talk Crazy.
It's actually, there is a recording of it, but it's not really, we're going to re-record it.
Is it on an album or?
It's not. It came out in a book of poems. The book of poems had a CD and they asked me would I want to put a song on it. So I did. And I'm so proud of it. I love that it's so complete, you know.
It tells a story, yeah. and it tells a story kind of in dialogue with the two characters. You want to describe the two characters, and then you can do the song for
Yes. It's a guy who volunteered to go to war, and the story, him telling the story of what happened to him, and his wife comes in on the chorus to reassure him. And it's what I imagine happens in the world of people that go to war, which I haven't done, but I think it's pretty realistic in some ways.
Okay, so this is Mark Mulcahy performing for us, and Ken Murray is playing guitar. And I should say this is a kind of long song, so I've asked you both to shorten it, so I just want our listeners to know that the song is a little bit longer and fuller than what we're going to hear.
Yeah, thank you for letting us do it.
In my blind romantic eye, I made a simple supposition to go away and come back one day and pick it up right where we left off. But I was wrong and you went along, smiling and waving as the bus pulled out of town. It was my mistake to make you wait, And now I know I'll be lucky if you even ever want me to come back. Well, don't talk crazy, I couldn't bear saying goodbye. All I did was wish that you wouldn't die. Just come back to me with that same look. Just come back to me, baby, with that same look in your eye. You make it seem like you always knew, had a premonition like I never do. Now I'm flat out in a hospital bed, staring at the ceiling fan spinning slowly over my head. I don't wanna hear you say I'm a hero. Honest to God, I was just trying to get out of the way. And now they gave me a purple heart, but honey, I don't want it. Maybe we'd both be better off if I just came home in a box. Well, don't talk crazy and please don't make me more afraid than I already am. Not for myself, it's you, I'm fine. I'm fine as long as I know I'll be seeing you soon. Yeah, well, maybe I feel the same way. But after all this time, and now I'm just a part of what I was. Wanted to carry my daughter upstairs to bed at night. Now they write that it's a sacrifice. It's all yours, not mine. Now you're there, and I'm still here. You've got everything, and baby, all I got to offer is me. Well, don't talk crazy about how it's gonna be. 'Cause baby, you were never far away from me. Maybe things are different, but nothing's changed. Just come home to me, baby. Please come home. Please come home.
That's Mark Mulcahy performing his song Don't Talk Crazy, accompanied by Ken Murie on guitar. We'll hear more of their interview and performance after a quick break. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with singer and songwriter Mark Mulcahy. Before becoming a solo artist, Mulcahy was in the college rock band Miracle Legion, which formed in Connecticut in the early 80s.
So, you know, so you get into a band, Miracle Legion, and it does well, but not that well. I mean, like, it's not like an incredibly famous band. No. It had its following, but and then you got into record label hell with the band too, right?
Right. We had a great start, and then it was just sort of a roller coaster of ups and downs. And then the end of the ride was really when we signed to a really big Hollywood label. We were on maybe three labels, and the Hollywood label was just very difficult to figure out what they wanted, and they wouldn't let us out, and they wouldn't let us in, and so we just flopped around for about 2 years, and ended up fizzling out. And two of the guys joined another band, one of the guys just kind of quit the whole thing, and I fell into this TV show, doing the music for a TV show on Nickelodeon.
Pete and Pete.
Right, the Adventures of Pete and Pete. And it was, you know, a pretty big challenge to do it. But they were good. The writers of that show, they knew what they wanted. And they wanted me to write the theme song. And it was write a theme song for the show, but don't say anything about the show.
Well, you succeeded.
And so, so luckily I had a song that I thought would be good, but I had recorded it some other time. And so I pretended that I wrote that for them, and they loved it right off the bat.
Well, it's a funny thing. Like you say, it had nothing to do with the show. The song is called "Hey Sandy." And in the opening credits for the show, you see all the different characters and their names are written on the screen. There's no Sandy.
No.
So it's
you're
like,
waiting for Sandy.
What does this song have to do with the show? But obviously it worked.
Somehow, instantly, they loved it.
Yeah, play us the song.
Okay.
Would you do that?
Yes. Okay.
1, 2, 3, 4. Hey, smile, strange. You're looking happily deranged. A keener sailor she met. Oh, have you picked your song? Yeah, yeah. Hey, Sandy. Ay, 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 ay. Does your dog bite? Ay, 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 ay. Hey, Sandy. 5 feet away. End of speech. Well, that's the end of your day. And we was only funny. But guiltily I thought it had it coming. Hey, Sandy. Ay, 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 ay. Hey. Does your dog a bite? Yeah, yeah, yes, Sandy.
Okay, so that's the theme from The Adventures of Pete and Pete, the old Nickelodeon series, Hey Sandy, written by my guest Mark Mulcahy, who's with us to talk about his music and sing some. And accompanying him on guitar is Ken Murie. So I was hoping I'd understand that third line that everybody wants to know, what is he singing there? Because after the first two lines, hey, smiling strange, you're looking happily deranged, no one knows what you're saying. This is yeah. Big thing on the internet with people wondering, like, what is that third line? It sounds to me like, I'll give you some Lashimbe, or what can you say Lashimbe? You would make news if you told us what the heck you were saying there.
Yeah.
You going to do that for us?
No. I don't want to tell anybody because I have so few secrets in my life. But also, I don't think anyone would want to know what it is. That's become my opinion about it. I don't think it would please anyone to know what it is.
Ken, do you know what he's saying?
I have no idea.
No one knows.
Seriously,
no.
You don't know either?
No, no.
How many times have you done it together?
I don't know, 10 or something. But
okay. Not that much. But no. You know, come on. How often do you get a secret? You know?
So now that you know you've done a theme song that was very much loved by the people who watch the show.
Yeah.
Do you have any favorite TV themes? Like, did you grow up really enjoying any TV themes?
Oh well, yeah. I mean, I think there was. I don't know now, but I think it was a golden age of it was very important to write a great theme song. And when I was watching television a lot more than I am now. So, yeah, there's a million great ones.
Would you sing a favorite TV theme for us?
Yes, I would. I would sing Maude if I could. Yeah, I think I'd love that one. The show, it's called just Maude, right? It wasn't called something Maude. Yeah, let's try Maude. I didn't know what I was getting into when I walked in this place. I didn't plan on singing Maude.
Lady Godiva was a freedom rider. She didn't care if the whole world looked. Joan of Arc had the Lord to guide her. She was a sister who really cooked. But Isabella was the first bra burner. Ain't you glad that she showed up? And when the country was falling apart, well, Betsy Ross got it all sewn up. And then there's Maude. Oh, and then there's Maude.
That was really fun. Oh, I love TV themes and jingles and stuff like that.
Yeah, I'd love to get in that game of writing stuff like that.
Jingles. Would you really?
Yeah.
Why would you want to do that? Because it's so catchy, you have to come up with hooks. It's all a hook.
It's very short. Yeah, it's very like
it's just a hook.
One line, sing the name of the company,
Yeah.
It's really funny.
Well, I'd love it if you did another song from the new album. Do you want to choose one to do?
We're going to do Badly Madly, maybe? Yeah.
Sure, Badly.
Do you want to introduce it, since the stories behind the songs are always so different from what you'd expect?
Badly Madly. Well, the thing is, this record, I made a lot of it up. Some of them are about somebody. There's the Heath Ledger one and there's the one about my friend. But I wanted also to try to just be fictional and write songs that I just invented a story in my head to write about, which I don't usually do. I'm usually writing about me or somebody else or things I see. And my goal was to try to, you know, be just clever, you know. So some of it's just clever. This is probably one of the more just attempts at cleverness. So I hope it sounds clever now that I've said that. It's so clever. He's so clever. I love him. Okay, so Badly Madly. Hey, one, two, three.
Well, I'd have liked to have seen him apologize, but he didn't. And I don't mind if he lied, why? Does he hold back on saying that he's sorry? I don't believe he'd feel as badly if he loved you madly like I do. You're waiting for him to say the magic words, but in plain English, baby, what have you heard? I don't believe he'd feel as badly if he loved you madly like I do. Like I do. I know you fell in love and you're getting married, but then you fell in love with yourself. You married everybody else, and now I feel so badly because I love you madly. Send fresh flowers if you would, and send citrus for Christmas. If you happen to see him again, be yourself, be kind, because he'll feel so badly because he didn't love you.
That's Mark Mulcahy performing live in the Fresh Air studio, accompanied by Ken Murray on backing vocals and guitar. You'll find a longer version of their visit to the Fresh Air studio on our website, freshair.npr.org. The rise of on-demand video content delivered over the internet has made it possible to watch many movies and TV shows anytime, anywhere. But with so many choices available at our fingertips, deciding what to watch can be a bit daunting. In an attempt to help viewers find something that appeals to them, Netflix presents its subscribers with personalized viewing recommendations. Fresh Air tech contributor Alexis Madrigal explains how and why they do it.
In the old days, a movie genre was a simple communal category: action-adventure, comedy, drama. One had to locate oneself in the drama aisle at the video store and then look for just the right thing. A dark road trip movie with a strong female lead? Aha, Thelma and Louise. But Netflix, the movie streaming and DVD rental service, doesn't work like that. It recommends genres that are intensely, almost bizarrely personalized. Netflix might tell you not just that you like road trip movies, but that you like understated romantic road trip movies, dark road trip thrillers, road trip art house movies, road trip musicals, or, of course, Canadian independent road trip movies. That's because 7 years ago, Todd Yellen, a film-obsessed executive at Netflix, set out to break down every movie into data. He hired aspiring screenwriters and paid them to watch movies and rate their levels of romance, gore, quirkiness, and even plot resolution. In a sense, Yellen wanted to reverse engineer all the Hollywood formulas so that Netflix could mathematically show you the movies they knew you would like. Now it's become one of the company's big selling points. Netflix doesn't just provide streaming movies and TV shows, it knows you. Thinking about how specific Netflix could get, I started to wonder, just how many microgenres does Netflix really have? A friend pointed out that the web addresses for the categories in the Netflix database were sequentially numbered, and that I could type through each URL one by one and figure out all the microgenres. The first brought up African-American crime documentaries. The second pulled up scary cult movies from the 1980s. The next was tearjerkers from the 1970s. After a couple more minutes, I tried entry 10,000 just to see if the database was really that big. Japanese horror movies from the 1960s was in that slot. There was no way I could copy and paste tens of thousands of genre titles by hand. So I wrote a simple script, a little piece of code that would copy the names to a list. I set it up to run, and then I waited, as the script kept copying and pasting for more than 20 hours. I found that Netflix has 76,897 separate categories. To my knowledge, no one outside Netflix has ever compiled this massive data before, and now we can really understand how the system works. The microgenres are formed from Netflix's version of Mad Libs, an algorithm that takes all the tags in Netflix's system and combines them based on specific criteria, especially the number of movies fitting the category. Traditional genres like drama form the center of each microgenre, but Netflix can toss in actors and directors and a bunch of descriptors including time period, location, age level, and the squishier human words, the adjectives. These are really what make Netflix's movie genre seem uncannily precise. Netflix's favorite adjective is romantic, which appears in 5,272 categories. Following it are foreign, classic, dark, British, critically acclaimed, suspenseful, gritty, independent, visually striking, family, violent, and feel-good. But not all the adjectives are used thousands of times. Some of the least used adjectives are telling too: experimental, screwball, satanic, stoner, visionary, and depression era. Hollywood's a popularity contest, though, so we have to ask, which actor is the most Netflix famous? That is to say, which actor appears in the most Netflix microgenres? The number two answer is precisely who you might expect: Bruce Willis, who has 17 dedicated categories, including violent action thrillers starring Bruce Willis. But the actor with the most categories dedicated to himself is not Tom Cruise or Angelina Jolie or Jackie Chan or Meryl Streep or Clint Eastwood or Doris Day, but Raymond Burr, star of Perry Mason. Why? I have no idea. Even Todd Yellen, who created the Netflix system, was baffled by the number of Burr categories. And that's the interesting thing wandering through Netflix's big data. Only some of the logic that drives these categories feels human. But perhaps that's exactly what we like about Netflix's recommendations. They take our taste, break it down into its constituent parts, and spit it back to us in new and revealing ways. Netflix's strange machine wants to make us happy, and to do so, it must know us and our culture in ways that are not always obvious to humans. How else do we explain the Raymond Burr phenomenon? That's the eye of software staring into the American soul.
Alexis Madrigal is a senior editor at The Atlantic and a visiting scholar at Berkeley's Center for Science, Technology, Medicine, and Society. He created an interactive web page where you can explore the 76,897 genres in Netflix's database and have fun creating new ones. The web page includes a Netflix genre generator. You'll find a link to that page on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, Mark Olson and Will Sheffer talk about their HBO series, Getting On. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. We're going to hear Terry's interview with Mark V. Olson and Will Sheffer. They created the HBO series Big Love, which ran for 5 seasons before it ended in 2011. Olsen and Sheffer's latest HBO series is a comedy called Getting On. It's set in the women's geriatric extended care wing of a Southern California hospital and is told from the perspective of doctors and nurses dealing with patients near death who have dementia and often don't know where they are. The stressed-out nurses are dealing with bodily fluids, end-of-life issues, and doctors and patients who don't appreciate what they do. But yes, it's a comedy. Getting On is adapted from the BBC series of the same name, but has a lot of new material that comes out of the experiences Sheffer and Olsen had when their mothers were in care facilities at the end of their lives. Here's a scene from the first episode. After some fecal matter is discovered on a chair in the common area, the head nurse of the unit, Dawn Forchette, played by Alex Borstein, is going over the incident report prepared by Nurse Dee Dee Ortley, played by Niecy Nash. It's Dee Dee's first day on the unit. Dawn, the head nurse, speaks first.
Found a feces in a chair. No. The incident reports need to be really, really specific.
Okay, what else should I put?
Well, for starters, it's not a feces, it's just feces.
But it wasn't a gang of them, it was just one piece.
But there's no singular form for feces. It's not feces or a feces, it's just feces. Who found it?
Me.
And when did they find it?
I found it. See, this is my name right here.
Technically, because it's a potential agent of infection, we would have environmental services come down to collect it, but the backlog is horrendous, so I'm just going to go ahead and have you red bag it.
If it'll make it quicker, I could just pick it up with a Kleenex, wipe off the chair with some bleach.
Boom. Yeah, that might be what you do at home, but you cannot do that in the hospital.
Well, Sheffer and Mark Olsen, welcome back to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the series. I want you to describe the premise in your words.
We used to say you can't avoid death and taxes in this culture, but it's gotten to the point now where you can't avoid death, taxes, and caring for the elderly. And really, you know, we are all dealing with this now, and we wanted to find a safe, funny, warm place that we could come as an audience and experience that.
It's funny. I think both Will and I have over the course of the last 5-10 years, been devoted to the care of our mothers who are aging, and I think we've both had different takeaways from it and different pieces that we've learned or have become important to us or whatnot. An additional item for me on this show is going through my mother's care and going through it with her extended team of caregivers. There's such a value to the work that those people do that we kind of wanted to take a different approach to the workplace comedy. And instead of dramatizing or highlighting the ways in which the workplace dehumanize us and make us invisible and whatnot, we wanted to actually celebrate the workplace and celebrate the fact that in many instances, particularly amongst this group of caregivers, it gives value to a life. And that's something that was very much on at least both our minds, I think.
Yes, but.
Yes, but.
You know, there's one of the nurses in there, Dee Dee, is just, she has such a gift for wiping somebody's behind in the gentlest, most respectful way, knowing how to lift somebody out of a chair and clean up puke and stuff. She's just wonderful at what she does. She's incredibly undervalued. But, you know, there's other people who work there who are really like going through the motions but think that they are the most wonderful caregivers and they're, you know, in touch with death and really like they're not even paying attention half the time. and you know, for those of us who've had loved ones in facilities, we've seen both extremes.
I think, you know, in our show, you know, we love all these characters, even the crazy ones who are sort of all wrapped up in their own egos and sometimes miss the point of what they're doing. And I think you're right, Terry, that we've witnessed both extremes. You know, Mark's mom, we brought her out here to California, and out here there are these little boarding care places where you can have skilled nursing that are sort of the opposite of what our show dramatizes, which is a more institutional wing, a more, you know, nursing home-like, you know, wing of a hospital. And we used to love going to see Mark's mom, you know, and be with the 3 or 4 women who had Alzheimer's there and the family who cared for them, because we laughed a lot there, and we felt like we were in a family. My mom in New York City, on the other hand, would be shipped out of a hospital into one of these rehabs, and I'd have to go get her out, which was a real process of, like, getting her out under orders that I should not do that by the doctors there. You know, and that was the experience I think you're referring to, where it just seemed like an elder mill, where the elderly were ignored. And we're sort of trying to mix both those experiences that we had and also do something with our characters where you can fall in love with even the most careless of our caregivers.
Okay, well, knowing the trips that you had to make so frequently in the final time of your mother's life, there's a scene I want to play from your new series, Getting On. And this is a scene in which Molly Shannon plays the daughter of one of the women in this extended care facility. And Molly Shannon, like, flies in, you know, it's been a 7-hour trip, and she wants to talk to the doctor, and she has her ideas of what the doctor should be doing, which, of course, irritates the doctor. And I think most people who have a parent in a geographically distant place has experienced something similar to this to this scene. So this is Molly Shannon as the patient's daughter, and Laurie Metcalf as Dr. Jenna James.
Dr. Jenna James, how can I help?
Yeah, my mother's in a lot of pain.
Yes, we're doing the very best we can to alleviate that.
Yes, it's just that I, and gosh, I know nothing about this, of course, but I did read on the internet.
We caution relatives not to do too much Googling, a little knowledge.
I did drive 7 hours to get here, so I feel a responsibility to be my mom's advocate. And I did read that people with my mother's level of pain should be on either tramadol or a more like morphine-based drug like Oramorph.
Well, the internet is awash with other drugs that people could be on, but rest assured, we are doing our very best.
I printed up this, with all respect to you.
No, well, it could be this, could be that, but I've considered the many choices.
I think what Dr. James is saying is that there's always alternatives.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It could be oxycodone, hydromorphone, Percocet, pethidine, morphine, Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe.
You know what? I really feel like nobody's listening to me. I'm trying to show you this, and I feel like nobody's letting me talk.
You're absolutely talking, and I'm absolutely listening.
No, I'm trying to tell you that she is in pain. She needs more help in dealing with her chemotherapy.
No, there's no chemo.
What do you mean there's no chemo?
Well, the tumors were much more invasive than we thought and were well beyond chemo. Dr. Lucchini said that this was all explained on the phone.
This was not explained to me. Dr. Lucchini told me that he would be sending her to rehab.
Yes, well, sometimes rehab is the palliative... I'm sure there's a note in the notes.
Well, may I see the notes?
No, you won't be able to understand
my mom's
the notes.
So I think I have a right to see my mom's notes. I'd like to see the notes.
Yes, but they are misunderstood or misinterpreted, and usually in very negative ways. For example, SOB, that's not going to mean what you think it's going
to mean. So palliative? So what are you saying? Are you saying she's dying?
Yes.
Okay, that's a scene from Getting On, and my guests, Will Sheffer and Mark Olson, are the creators and writers of this new HBO series. So did you have scenes in your life that were similar to that, where you kind of flew in and either found out something that you should have already known but nobody told you, or you had suggestions that the doctor didn't really want to hear?
We go through our scripts, and we can usually assign etiology. This is a 90% I experienced it. This is a 10% you experienced that. This is probably a 2/3 Will experienced and a 1/3 Mark experienced. Most of those moments Will experienced with his mom in New York. Sort of, you know, landing in the land of Stalinist, Maoist, medical doublespeak and trying to penetrate it.
Yeah, you know, this kind of having to advocate, you know, endlessly for your loved one, it takes all of your energy, and you have to really suck it up. And, you know, I would Google things, and knowing, that it was probably not a good idea, but, you know, I'd go right up to the doctor and just get into it with them. And, of course, doctors don't like being challenged. They're the experts. And but this was my experience largely with dealing with doctors.
Yes, and the Molly Shannon scene also reminded me of trying to walk that line between advocate and pest. And you never know which side of the line the medical staff perceives you as being on.
I think that's spot on, you know, because... you have to learn this kind of strategy of, like, I'm going to be firm, yet I'm not going to alienate anybody, you know. So it's this dance that you do when you get to the hospital of like, I'm going to get that nurse to give my mother another painkiller, but I'm going to do it in a nice way so that they don't hate me, you know. And there have been all sorts of – I have lots of stories of like I fired nurses from rooms.
Well, yeah, I think actually I took a whack on the first draft of that scene, and part of it was channeling anecdotes that Will brought back, you know, over the years with his mother's care in New York, and part of it was just eavesdropping on his care of me when I was in UCLA hospital with some major surgery 4 or 5 years ago, and just it was sort of an armchair seat watching him as an advocate. Trying to fire nurses, trying to get different antibiotics, trying to get, you know, a different regimen of healthcare and a different treatment plan going, and it pretty fierce stuff.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Will Sheffer and Mark Olson. They created Big Love, the HBO series, and did a lot of the writing for it, and now they're the creators of the new HBO series Getting On, which is set in the extended care wing of a hospital in Southern California. So there's some wonderful actresses playing the older patients in the extended care facility in your series, and I'm wondering what casting them is like. Are they retired actresses?
And the extras are mostly just, you know, women who have gotten into extra acting work after the retirement. And so we had a wonderful extra casting agent and also, you know, extras casting agent who brought us wonderful faces, and we were able to see who we really, you know, could work with, and sometimes we'd give them a speaking bid. And we just, you know, here we are in Southern California, the land of face work, and, you know, we knew that we wanted our show to be authentic, and we had to find authentic elderly people to fill out a lot of the background.
Well, and that's true as to the extras. We wanted a great tableau to or a great backdrop, a great background of great faces, as it were. It's almost Norma Desmond-esque. We wanted faces in our show, but there's such an amazing pool of incredibly gifted actresses, you know, in up in years. And I don't want to say that it was, you know, ripe for the picking, because these women do, obviously still work. June Squibb, for God's sakes, is, you know, legendary in the film Nebraska that's just out. But, you know, and when Ann Gilbert came in, she has a nice role that runs the course of the season, and she was Millie in the Dick Van Dyke Show. And when Ann, she was
Birdie.
Millie Helper. You know, that's who she is. And when Ann Jeffries came in, it's like, my God,
Ann Jeffries from Topper?
Yes.
The mostess?
She was Donna in episode 2. I mean, or episode 3, I'm sorry.
No, episode 2.
Episode
You're right.
2. Yeah. Who played the who had the one featured moment in a film in the 40s called Singer in a Gift Box in our show.
Oh, and they Google her. They Google to find and they find out she was beautiful when she was young. Wow.
Exactly. You know, and June Squibb, it's like writing for these women is joyous. Having them on the set is joyous. You know, when we did Big Love and got to hang around Harry Dean Stanton, you know, we developed a keen appreciation for Hollywood legends. And well, Harry's, you know, more than just a legend, but he's an amazing human being. But these women are they're treasures, and we adore being able to write for them and give them parts.
So I have to ask you: you are legally married now, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we are.
So has that affected your health care? I know you could probably afford health care. I mean, you do HBO series. You're not poor. But still, has it affected either like your health care or your ability to do things like have all the perks, like if one of you or one of your loved ones is in the hospital, to have all the perks that are allowed only immediate family?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, when I had to take care of Mark at UCLA, we weren't legally married, and I remember having to sort of fight my way sometimes into a room and say, I am his domestic partner, and, you know, it was tough, and sort of, I guess, demeaning would be the word that comes to mind, but we have a good healthcare policy through the Writers Guild of America, thank goodness. But if before we were legally married, before this year, we were to pool our healthcare as a married couple and take benefits as a domestic partner, let's say, before we were married, we had to pay taxes on those benefits. And now that we're married, that goes away.
And God knows it's made just you know, when DOMA fell and the federal government changed its stripes, it made all, just incredible differences in you know inheritance and the macabre Byzantine way we had to structure our estates and whatnot to
as we
protect each other.
As we think about getting on, you know, ourselves as a married as a gay married couple, you know, it was always really scary to figure out what was going to happen with our, you know, with our lives, how we were going to take care of each other, how if one of us died first, it was going to affect the other. And I have to say that it was a tenuous situation still for us, you know, as a not recognized married couple in California, federally. And, you know, this year we filed our first, you know, joint tax form together. And that was a huge symbolic step for us. I mean, this has been a huge experience being recognized federally as a married couple.
Since you mentioned thinking ahead to the future about getting on yourselves, having just done this series, Getting On, do you worry about what happens, you know, years from now if you get, you know, chronically ill or dementia or something and you end up needing full-time care?
Terry.
Yes.
Worried about it. It consumes every waking thought that we have on our commutes to work, standing in line at the bank. It's all we think about. We have internal debates. We toss coins. Who's going first? I'm not sticking around if you're not here, and you're not gonna leave me holding the bag. And
do we have enough railings in our house?
Yeah, we redid our house over the last couple of years, and trying to think prospectively, but not wanting to tip our cards too much, we insisted that we needed a few more wash rag hangers in the in the bathtub, when really we were basically talking about grab bars and trying to be prepared for the future.
Mark V. Olson and Will Sheffer created the HBO series Getting On. The 6-part series is now available on demand. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sharrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our assistant producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.